and we were talking about this and that. And I think it was about 1985 or so. And so I told him the story about my first retreat and how all my flashbacks started happening while I was sitting, and I thought I was losing my marbles. But then, you know, finally, just through doing the practice and also a lot of metta for myself, I was able to use the Dharma for the purpose of some pretty profound healing. And Justin said, you know, you should write that down. That's a really good story. And so I eventually did. I gave it to him, and then I guess it was 1988, was it, Don, when you did your first edition of Buddhist America? It was kind of a whole Buddha catalog. It was all the sites, you know, all the various traditions that had retreat centers or sitting groups or something around the country, and then there were narratives that were presented by each of the traditions. Don edited, put it together, and I think there were two or three editions, maybe, something, right? So, at any rate, Don asked me if I would do an entry for the Theravada section, you know, just kind of an example of kind of how it works and how the practice operates. And so, when he asked me to do that, I thought about what my contribution might be. And so I gave him that narrative, actually. So the first place that it actually appeared in print was in Don's book. 1988, was it? Buddhist America? Yeah. You're mute. You're muted, Don.
Yeah. The first edition was in 88, and the second edition was in 98. And I don't remember, but I think it appeared in the second edition, too, didn't it?
Could be, yeah.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
But by that time, the Dharma was popping up like dandelions all over the country, and so it got to the point where it was kind of a whole Dharma catalog. It was really cool, but I think that the field has continued to grow and grow. At any rate, so this afternoon I had occasion to read that through again. It just brought back those memories of how it first came into being. So that's what we're going to do this evening, actually, when we get through with our sit, is to have a look at peacemaking within, and then some of the corollaries or some of the ways the same dynamic that applies to how we discover inner peace also relate to how we make peace with the other, how we make peace with those with whom we may not agree, and how we might make it possible to live in a more peaceful and harmonious society than the one that we inhabit right now. So in the 1920s and 30s, in Europe, when Mussolini in Italy and Hitler in Germany were in the process of engineering the violent overthrow of the democratic governments in those countries. And in Italy, Mussolini had a support group called Black Shirts, because they all wore black shirts, and they were a violent extremist group that attacked and assassinated and killed political opponents and basically terrorized the political scene. And in Hitler's Germany, it was Brown Shirts. It was the same thing. Their nickname was Stormtroopers, but they were also referred to as Hitler's Brown Shirts. There were some who, during the current troubles, with these right-wing, heavily armed militias showing up at protests and voting places and whatnot, that were coming to sort of think of these as Trump's brown shirts. So it occurred to me, after listening to the president-elect's speech yesterday evening, that maybe what President Biden needs us some purple shirts. A peacemaking fort, you know. So that's why I happen to be dressed as I am. See if we can start a purple shirt movement. But first, let's do some sitting practice together. So let's go ahead and take a moment to find a sitting posture. It doesn't matter if you're sitting on a chair or a cushion, kick back in your favorite chaise lounge, whatever makes it possible for you to be centered and at ease. And relaxed, but also awake and alert. So sitting upright with your shoulders back and your head up is a good way to do that. Arms relaxed at our sides and hands either folded in the lap or maybe resting on your legs. And then allowing the eyes to gently close. And the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Whether you notice it mostly as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, or maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen. And taking just a few moments to allow our attention to the process of breathing, to clear the mind, still the mind, and make it possible for us to look within. For the first few breaths, you can experiment with breathing out and hold and taking a little longer to breathe out than you do to breathe in, so that with each exhalation you're allowing the body to come into a deeper state of relaxation. And then allowing the in-breath likewise to slow up a little and to maybe go a little deeper into the body, so you're breathing from your abdomen. Deep, peaceful in-breath, a long, slow, relaxing out-breath, and a pause in between. As the mind becomes more calm and clear. And the mind-body process becomes more relaxed. And then as the mind becomes a little calm, a little more calm and clear, letting go of seeking to breathe in any particular way, but simply noting instead how the body is breathing itself. Whether you're breathing a long breath or a short one, a deep breath or a shallow one, a rapid breath or a slow one. Allowing the mind to find in the mind-body process, allowing the body to find a breathing that is of its own natural accord and depth and pace and rhythm. Of your body that you share with all living beings. Mm-hmm. and then allowing the field of awareness to expand to take in not only the breathing, but also bodily sensations and sounds and thoughts and emotions. Allowing whatever becomes the mind's primary object of attention to likewise become the object of meditation. And to examine each of these phenomena in their turn as they arise and change and pass away. Anyone have any Dharma-related or Sangha-related announcements you'd like to share this evening? Okay. Anything from the Sangha, Kathleen?
No, it looks like Jim has an announcement.
Okay, good. Thank you,
Jim.
And thank you again, as usual, Kathleen, for doing our RT hosting tonight. I appreciate it.
You are welcome.
Gail, I'm not sure this is Dharma related, but I heard a rumor that we have a new president.
Yes, things have changed. And that's, of course, one of the, that's something we'll be touching on this evening. So, good. All right. So, as Jim pointed out, we seem to be about to have new leadership in our country. And President-elect Biden has said that he hopes to lead an effort to unify the nation, to heal us from some of the terrible divisions that we've been suffering in a particularly open and raw and painful way the last few years. That being said, it took many years for us to find ourselves where we do today in terms of social divisions across a really, a great number of dimensions. And it's going to take at least that long to heal from it. And so that's really one of the things I want to talk about tonight. What does it mean to make peace. And I want to talk about it in two ways, okay? One is, what does it mean to make peace with ourselves? And the other is, what does it mean to make peace with the other, those whom we find it difficult to communicate with, to be with, okay? Because there is a real relationship, at least in Buddha Dharma, between the two. How do we relate to ourselves? How do we relate to others? So, like I was saying before we began our time together in practice this evening, I was rereading Jack Kornfield's book, A Path with Heart, and in particular, the chapter that he wrote titled Stopping the War Within. And he says there that a lot of spiritual work is about that very thing. And it's exactly what the Buddha's starting point was when he went forth seeking to liberate his mind, to find spiritual freedom. There's a book, let me see, I'm going to give you the cite to it. Everyone see the site, Gil Fronsdale, The Buddha Before Buddhism. It's his commentary on one of the very earliest collections of discourses by the Buddha called The Book of Eight. I was just rereading that again today as well. What Gil says there, and this is among the most ancient texts that's out there having to do with, you know, what the historical Buddhas actually thought to have said, that it was may have been teachings that he offered within the first couple of years of his beginning to teach, because there isn't any reference to a monastic sangha, to a sangha of, bhikkhus. So he was very, very early on in his teaching. There's also no mention, interestingly, and this is why Gil gave the book the title that he did. There's no mention of the Four Ennobling Truths. There's no mention of the Eightfold Path. There's no mention of enlightenment, nirvana, right? Which in many ways sets it very much apart from what was to happen later on in terms of his teaching. In this book, in these very earliest teachings, when people asked the Buddha what it was that set him on his path, what were you going in search of? Okay. What he said was, I went in search of peace of mind. And what I discovered when I began my inquiry, when I went forth to study the inner life, was that the mind was in turmoil. The mind was set against itself. You know, the mind was my own worst enemy. Okay. And so, more than any outer forces or outer events, the outer environment, what he said was causing me suffering was what I encountered in my very own mind. And so my inquiry, my search ultimately turned out to be one for the roots or the origins or the arising of selfless, deep peace of mind. Really interesting. So I commend that book to you. It's really refreshing take on things. This is before all the doctrines and all the lists and the seven factors of enlightenment and the eightfold path and the six perfections and yada yada. It was like very simple and very straightforward. Peace of mind. So what gets in the way of it? Why is it difficult to achieve it? The Buddha talked about a mind in turmoil, the mind in which he found that he was automatically setting what he liked against what he did not like, those whom he liked against those whom he did not like. And a lack of compassion and kind regard for himself. And he ultimately decided that that is what he needed to establish for himself in order to achieve that which he saw. This, you know, a really deep peace of mind. So, it's really hard to bring peace to the world if you can't bring it to yourself, right? The two really do go together. The title of that chapter in Jack's book, The Path of Heart, the chapter Stopping the War Within is about that. It's the same thing that the Buddha had to do. And here's how Jack describes it. So when we step out of the battle, we see anew, as the Tao Te Ching says, with eyes unclouded by longing. We see how each of us creates conflict. We see our constant likes and our dislikes, the fight to resist all that frightens us. We see our own prejudice and greed, territoriality. All of this is hard for us to look at, but it is really there. Then underneath these ongoing battles, we see pervasive feelings of incompleteness and fear. We see how much our struggle with life has kept our heart closed. When we let go of our battles and open our heart to things as they are, then we come to rest in the present moment. This is the beginning and the end of spiritual practice. Only in this moment can we discover that which is timeless. Only here can we find the love that we seek. Love in the past is simply a memory, and love in the future is but fantasy. Only in the reality of the present can we love, can we awaken, can we find peace and understanding and connection with ourselves and the world. Nice work if you can get it, huh? So, what do we do when we're saying, well, that's, you know, nice gig. I mean, peace of mind, I can dig it. You know, where do I get some? And you sit to meditate and you're seeking peace of mind and the mind is in turmoil. So what do you do about that? What is it that causes us to not be able to accept the things that we see inside of ourselves that we don't like? Unwillingness to forgive ourselves for self-destructive behaviors, and therefore an unwillingness to forgive others who do the same thing. Okay, so forgiveness plays a pretty significant role in peacemaking in monastic sanghas in Asia. Even to this day, there is a in Southeast Asia, in the sanghas of bhikkhus, there is a tradition that's sometimes observed, especially in the more traditional monasteries. On the full moon night, there's a ceremony of reconciliation that is sometimes conducted. And living in a monastic environment, stuff arises, you know, but it's the job of a monastic to look within and be with those conflict of emotions and states of mind that the Buddha said needed to be investigated in order for real peace of mind to happen. And so if over the course of a month there has been, you know, different members of the Sangha that come into conflict with each other, okay, when the bhikkhu is ready to do so, the Sangha member, they're encouraged to do so when they're ready to do so, is to go to the person who they may have offended or who may have offended them, and to say, for any ways that I may have caused you harm, either knowingly or unknowingly, through anything I may have thought or said or done, I ask your forgiveness. For any ways you may have harmed me, either knowingly or unknowingly, through anything that you have thought or said or done, I forgive you. And the purpose of that ceremony is to resolve conflict within the Sangha, to allow everyone to live together peacefully. Because the longer those chronic conflicts go unresolved, the more detrimental it becomes both one's practice and also the Sangha as a whole. There is a famous story of, you know, the quarrel at Kasambi, and it was a monastic Sangha, and they split right down the middle, you know, kind of like our last election. And you were very evenly divided within the Sangha, each of them following one of the two senior leaders within the Sangha, and they just got into it big time, and they really lined up, and they were both super attached to their own views and their own champion in the, among the senior monastics. And they asked the Buddha to come in and help resolve it, and he came three times and tried to chill them out, and they just kept going at it, and eventually the surrounding community, the lay people whose Dana had been supporting the Sangha, said, you know, these guys are, they don't know what they're talking about. They're completely incapable of living the lives that they tell us we should be living. They're not living the Dharma. So they stopped giving them Dana, and the whole place collapsed. Right? And so it's that inability to put the Buddha's teachings into practice in community that resulted in the failure of the Sangha. There's a quote that I like, an observation I like from the Tibetan tradition. It says, all about us the earth is covered in sharp stones. We can seek to cover the entire earth with soft leather, or we can put soft leather on the soles of our feet. All about us our 10,000 enemies are arrayed. We can seek to conquer them all, or we can conquer the hatred in our own hearts. So that's what we're about, you know. When Mahatma Gandhi was prior to winning or achieving independence from colonial Britain, Gandhi was interviewed once about the difficulties of his path, you know, what it was like to lead this liberation movement, and what did he consider his greatest victories, and what do you consider his greatest challenges, you know. And he said, I basically have three adversaries. Among the three, the ones I'm finding it easiest to work with are the British. He said, because within them are the seeds of decency. You know, they know that their colonial rule ultimately is untenable because it's not in accord even with their own values. He said, more difficult, like my political opponents in Indian society, because they are so convinced of the rightness of their views. And eventually, it was one of them assassinated him. He said, but the third and most difficult is that fellow Mohandas K. Gandhi. He said, with him, I have very little influence. He was talking about himself, right? very revelatory, very ennobling that he was, he was leading, the largest, social liberation movement in the history of the world at the time. He found that was his principal adversary. So what do we do about that? How do we make peace with ourselves? Because that turns out to actually be the key to being able to make peace in the world. When I came home from Vietnam in 1967, I very quickly went to work for my congressman, Mo Udall, of Southern Arizona, because he was one of the very first Democrats in the Congress to come out in opposition to the war. And so I was active in Arizona. I went to work for him on Capitol Hill. I was active, very active in Washington, D.C. And during that time, I think it was 1969, when the Vietnamese Zen master monk Thich Nhat Hanh had been leading a peace movement in Vietnam, and the war was raging, and he was simply trying to stop the war. He refused to take sides. He would not side with the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. He would not side with the South Vietnamese government, and therefore he was really disliked and mistrusted by both sides. Okay. And he went abroad went to Europe and the United States in 1969. And the South Vietnamese government forbade him from re-entering the country afterwards. And that's when he went to France and set up Plum Village. And he made a speaking tour of the United States. And he was a real dud. Didn't go over too well at all. And the reason is this, I heard him speak once, and this is, time when the anti-war sentiment was raging in the United States, massive demonstrations happening all over the country. I think it was in the Bay Area, maybe, when he was giving this speech to these throngs of people. And the reason that he wasn't a big hit is because he said, here in this country, you have a real problem. So the problem is that you have an anti-war movement, and what you need is a peace movement. Big difference, big difference, because it goes to intention. In an anti-war movement, you make the other your enemy. And for those of us who were there then and lived through it, that was a bloody violent time, much worse than anything that we've encountered here just recently. And on reflection, he was right, But our country and our culture being what it was, that turned out to be a pretty difficult thing to do, because he was really advocating nonviolence, and he was advocating non-dualism. He was advocating not making the other your enemy for the purpose of bringing peace. He said that, the Buddha said in, the Dhammapada, hatred will never put an end to hatred, love alone can. This is an unalterable law. That was actually that whole, the twin verses in the Dhammapada, we become what we think, although we are rising above it. Those were teachings he gave to the monastics at Kasambi. That was the advice he was giving them. If you want to live in accordance with my teachings, this is how you do it. This is the lesson that you have to learn. And they couldn't be able to do it. Hatred will never put an end to hatred, love alone can. And before you can be effective, or the extent to which we're able to be effective is really bounded by or directly related to how successful we are at making peace with ourselves. In 1982, when the Khmer Rouge overran Cambodia, the spiritual leader of Cambodia was a monk named Mahagosananda, and he happened to be out of the country. He happened to be in Thailand when the Khmer Rouge overran the country. And what they set about doing was killing everyone in any position of authority who opposed them. So they assassinated everybody in a leadership position in government. And they assassinated tens of thousands of monastics, of monks and nuns in Cambodia, in fairly brutal ways. And he was out of the country at the time, so what he began to do was to set up refugee camps in the countries surrounding Cambodia for all those who were fleeing the terror of the Pol Pot regime. You know, he had teenagers and young adults ordering them to kill their own parents. It was about as brutal and bloody as it gets. Over, I think, somewhere between 1 and 2 million people died during Khmer Rouge's rule in Cambodia. And in 1996, after the, you know, then this is after the North Vietnamese prevailed in the civil war in Vietnam. The Vietnamese invaded Cambodia and crushed Khmer Rouge just because they didn't want, you know, that unstable a government next door. In 1996, Mahagosananda was given a peace award for all the work that he had done to try to care for all the refugees, set up little villages and start growing vegetables and making it through this terrible time until they could return home. And so when he received this award, he was asked how he was able to avoid being consumed by rage at the Khmer Rouge for the way they had massacred, you know, all these thousands of monastics who he had responsibility for leading and caring for. And they asked him, how were you able to do this? And he said, the entire time I was making peace with myself, making peace with myself. Because without doing that on a continuing basis, there is no way that I could have been of assistance to others. So, kind of an important feature of his answer, I think, in there is that peace, making peace with oneself, is not a one and done. It's not just, okay, you do that, and now you can go out and save the world, you know. And that's also what Gandhi was saying, right? It's an ongoing process. You make peace with yourself. You work on an ongoing basis on being your own best friend so that you can be a better friend to others and so that you can live in a way that does not instill fear in the other, that does not instill anger in the other. So there's that. Anyone have any thoughts about anything that I've said so far that you can relate to?
Yes, Lloyd, Tara Lloyd, I do. I went to a talk with Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, certainly after when you did, but when he made a tour here, and I bought a calligraphy, and the when you bought the calligraphy, it was used to support the monastics, the monks and nuns. And I have one that Thich Nhat Hanh did that said, peace within yourself, peace in the world. And then there was a calligraphy of a circle And I have that on my wall in my living room as a reminder.
Well done.
To myself, you know.
Yeah. No, it's a real core message. And it really is, I think, very much at the heart of applying our practice and our understanding to our life in the world. And I think that we're at a real crossroads right now. I think that there is a real opportunity to really put our practice experience, our understanding into practice and helping to heal our society in a way that maybe didn't exist before or hasn't existed in such an evident way. And so it's one of the things that really kind of drew me to want to give this talk tonight is just that. Any other thoughts anyone has or questions, anything they'd like to share?
Yeah, hi, Tara Lloyd, this is Mario.
Hey, Mario.
Yeah, hi. So I had some thoughts about what you were saying in the context of, in the contemporary context, in terms of what's going on right now in this country. And so, you know, you were talking about how Thich Nhat Hanh mentioned that in the U.S. there was an issue with the fact that it was an anti-war movement rather than a pro-peace movement or peace movement.
Yeah.
Well, I see some of that even today, and so maybe I should just start off by disclosing that, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump, but I see that at times when you hear or see or notice that there's an anti-Trump movement, and that tends to cause, to see, the current president and his supporters as others, kind of what you were saying earlier, like it was just it becomes tribal, and you don't see them, and there's dualism going on, which is not necessarily in line with the Dharma. So
exactly,
that's just something that I wanted to bring up. So
yeah. And thank you. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. When I've seen these heavily armed men, just about universally, somewhere between about 18 and 30 or 40 years of age, Euro-American men, showing up at these demonstrations, and there is such vocal hatred, what in the Buddha Dharma understanding of the nature of mind in terms of aversion, both hate and fear have the same energy source. They come from the same place. And so while it looks, if you're wearing, carrying around weaponry that's capable of, killing a lot of people in a short period of time, it looks aggressive and it looks like hate. For me, what I see instead is fear. And what I really begin to ponder, what is it that they are afraid of? And the way that I seek to approach to answer that question is by reflecting on when fear has arisen in my own heart. Where does that come from? What is it that I'm afraid of? Jack was talking about that in his passage in the book. It goes very deep. What we're afraid of, what the mind is afraid of, if you really go after it, in terms of investigation of the nature of mind, the nature of self, the nature of not self. The Buddha's teachings on not-self, when the mind gets really settled and you have some understanding of those teachings and you watch the arising and passing of self in the mind, that can likewise be frightening. that there is there can be this fear of a loss of identity, of disintegration, of ceasing to be. And so being able to be in touch with that is helpful for me in terms of best understanding what may be going on with the people who are living in such evident fear in our society today. It's also been helpful for me in reading Isabel Wilkerson's book on caste and the origins of our discontents, finding it to be a really powerful book. There's also aspects, as a genderqueer person, there's also real aspects of it I have real problems with. But at any rate, don't need to give a book report right now. But the insights that I do find really useful in that book, you know, caste basically is the hierarchical organization of any society in terms of wealth and influence. And it can be, the organizational principles can be a variety. It can be ethnic lineage. They can be socioeconomic status. But in this rigid hierarchical ordering, it's usually the caste level that feels itself to be most threatened by the level just below that is most brutal in policing the caste system itself. So in other words, a lot of the, at least the heavily armed Trump supporters that are out there, this, under this theory, what they're really afraid of is disempowerment and a loss of identity as another group is seeking to gain more power, is seeking to throw off the oppression that they've been subjected to historically in our society. There was a survey that was run a few months ago that I heard reported on the Radio Lab on public broadcasting. Interestingly, I never saw it in any of the larger mainstream media, but it, you know, it's a really interesting survey. It was a cross-cultural or comparative survey that was done of all the countries in Europe and in the United States in which there is a real arising of authoritarian anti-democratic leadership. And the question that was asked of respondents in several countries in Europe, as well as here in the United States, was, would you be willing to live in an authoritarian regime rather than a democracy in order to, if that was what was needed to protect your social status? Any idea what percentage of American responses answered in the affirmative? 30%. Okay. So 30% of the people in our country said they would prefer to live in an authoritarian regime rather than a democracy if that was what was necessary to protect their social status. Okay. So their devotion to their position in the caste system was greater than their devotion to living in a democracy. It's a pretty good bet that most of those people are among those who voted for the fellow who just got fired, because they saw him as protecting them from disempowerment and protecting them from loss of identity. So that's why I think, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, as Mauro pointed out, going forth, instead of there being an anti-Trump movement, there needs to be some kind of movement toward moving away from a society that is dominated by competition in the first place. You know, the dominant view, if you're in a caste system, is that it's a zero-sum game. And every level of the caste system is fighting for its share of wealth and influence in society. and that oppressed groups, as they seek to gain more, their perception is that it's happening at the expense of somebody else. That it's happening at the expense of the mass, next caste level up. And the only way to get around that ultimately is to reorganize society so that you begin to dismantle the caste system itself and you start trying to imagine what would a society look like in which the guiding principle was trying to help each other so that all can succeed rather than only some succeeding at the expense of the other. That's exactly the advice that the Buddha gave when he was asked about caste in his time. Okay. Said, whatever your place in society, it's the obligation of all in society to make sure that everyone is well cared for. And when you use the system to benefit some at the expense of others, that is dukkha. That is social dukkha. That causes war and conflict. That is what needs to be addressed. Okay. So he, you know, there's a really interesting Dharma talk that Gil Fronsdale gives called The Buddha as Activist. And you can, yeah, it's on YouTube, you can pull it up. But what he was saying is that, you know, when the Buddha talked about, oh, you know, the three kalesas, the torments, greed, attachment, aversion, and delusion, and that you need to replace them or cultivate, you know, swap them out for generosity, kindness, and wisdom. That it wasn't only about self-improvement. It was about the reorganization of society. That he was basically giving public policy advice in the way that he was teaching the Dharma. And the Buddha was a one percenter. He was born into a high caste. His father was the monarch of a minor kingdom in northeastern India. Jesus of Nazareth was a working stiff, and he hung out mostly with working class people. And as soon as he began to make racket, the scent started to sound as if it was going to be politically revolutionary, they whacked him. Right? The Buddha, on the other end, coming at it from the other end. He was wealthy and he had been wealthy, well-educated, and he found it easy to hang out with the richest, most powerful people in this part of India. And many of them became his benefactors and paid for the places where his monastics would hang out and whatnot. And so he spent a lot of time really advocating generosity, kindness, and wisdom as public policy criteria with these powerful people that he was with. And those monarchs and wealthy business people and whatnot who took up the Buddhist cause wound up creating much more favorable conditions for their people to live in. And so, and at the same time, the Buddha did not proselytize. He did not try to, you know, and this comes up in the discourse, the Kalamas Dilemma. He said, if your goal is my goal, which is the cessation of suffering, here's one way you can go about it. But don't take my word for it. Give it a try. See if it works. Okay. Ehi Patsiko. Come see for yourself. This is advice. And so the same is true for us. You know, it's not a matter of running out trying to convince everyone to be Buddhist. It's about running out there and taking a radical stance in support of generosity, kindness, and wisdom. And it doesn't actually get much more radical than that. When some of my own friends, Dharma teachers, were coming back from India India and Thailand in the early 1970s, and were being advised by their Asian teachers to come home and teach here in the U.S. A couple of them, let's see, when Energy, I guess, they said people go home, teach just two things. Don't sell the Dharma, right? Don't try to make a buck, because there were a lot of Indian teachers as well as Westerners who were making a handsome living marketing Eastern religious practice. And they also said, it doesn't matter whether you call it Buddhism, you know? Don't go home and start acting like it's your job to convince others to be Buddhists. Go home and teach the Dharma, and then let others decide for themselves. You know? In terms of transformation of our society, you know, probably the most useful thing that the people in following the Buddhist path could do, are among the most effective things, would be to make common cause with other faith traditions. Because at least insofar as how one lives your life, the parallels are quite stark. You know, there's a lot of similarity in terms, you know, you don't have to get off into doctrinal stuff about whether there's a God or not and all that. But just in terms of treating other people kindly and with generosity, you know, trying to reason together to find what is the wise path, you know, those are things that, you know, we're invited to do, and probably among the ways we could be most effective, you know. Getting back to the fear thing, and in Isabel's book, but also in public discourse generally, you hear the term 2042 raised a lot. Okay. 2042 is the year that demographers now are predicting will be the point in time in American history when there are no longer any minority groups. And the reason there will no longer be any minority groups is that there will be no majority group. So the shift in the ethnic identity of the people of the United States is in continuous flux. And it will continue to be. That's where we as a nation are headed. And so that is also another source for a lot of people of the fear, you know. Who am I if I am no longer in the dominant ethnic group in this country? You know, I lose my ability to maintain my status by virtue of my ethnicity. And for people who define themselves in those terms, right, the person, who are you, and the answer to that question, you know, usually the first thing that comes to mind is, well, what religion are you if you have one? What political party do you belong to? What is your ethnicity? Who are you? Where are your people? Right? And if we're entering into a time in our history where that is no longer the dominant of that ethnic lineage, Euro-Americans, is going to cease to be, that can be terribly disturbing for those whose sense of well-being and identity is all tied up in being part of the dominant caste. So although it's not the same as the fear that comes with experiencing loss of identity in terms of deep samadhi and disaggregation of self, the fear is quite similar. Okay. So how do we go about convincing each other in society that there's nothing to fear? Not so easy. not so easy. And it's especially not so easy if the people who are most afraid really, in fact, do have something to be afraid of, you know. And it's not necessarily that somebody who isn't the same color as them is going to take their job. They've been losing ground economically for a long time. My wife just finished a career as a midwife at University Hospital in UC Medical Center, where she was also nursing faculty. And she, her practice has won a great percentage of whose patients, clients, are Medicaid recipients, including emergency Medicaid, which is undocumented immigrants, for instance. It's where you can go for emergency care if you are indigent. And there are also a lot of people who go there who are not poor enough to just get public assistance, but have to pay a lot for not particularly good health insurance, but still go there because it's less costly than some other places to have a baby. And my wife said that she has had patients there, Euro-American women of modest means, but not outright poor, who feel some resentment, you know, because they say, you know, I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to finance taking care of this new child. We're barely making enough to live on as it is, and yet I see people coming into this clinic, you know, from abroad who aren't even here legally, who are getting free medical care, and they feel tremendous resentment at that, because it feels to them like undocumented immigrants are being treated better than they are and have it better than they do. And they find themselves very resentful of that. It's not my wife's place to, and she didn't, you know, tell these same people, maybe the problem is the healthcare system itself. You know, maybe everybody should have the kind of support and care that's being offered to indigenous people right now. That perhaps that's where the real inequities lie, you know, is the fact that our society's not structured in such a way as to make sure that everybody can be cared for who needs to be cared for. And that is where the attention really needs to be directed. And that's not necessarily a partisan thing. You know, a lot of the Affordable Care Act's ideas originating within the Republican Party. But the underlying principle that perhaps we really do have an obligation to use our institutions in such a way as to make sure everyone is cared for. You know, Dom Helder Camara, you know, he's Argentine Archbishop. Brazilian Archbishop. One of my favorite quotes of his, you know, when I ask for food for the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. But he's speaking the words of liberation theology. And I think that I think there lies within the Theravada texts a Theravada liberation theology also, but I think in some ways it's still waiting to be discovered. One that doesn't clearly align with one politics or another, but instead just rests on the teachings of the Buddha. So, please, other comment, reflection. Now's a good time. Please, Marilyn. Unmute, Marilyn. Unmute. Marilyn?
Okay, can you hear me now? Okay, thank you.
Yes.
You know, while I think it's while intellectually, what you said, what Mario said, and what you say about being anti-Trump makes a lot of sense to me. But my stomach, on the other hand, goes, think of all those children at the border. And it just makes me sick. I mean, how do you reconcile that sense of disgust at some of the behavior?
Yes.
It's like it's hard for me to understand how anybody could see that as, I don't know, as okay. So I have this, what the Buddhist philosophy seems really good in my head,
yes.
But my stomach is not there.
Yes. I think the key word that you put, that you use, that's really worth regarding is the word behavior.
Okay.
There are so many things that this president did that were like the example you just raised, that were cruel, which is the absolute antithesis. It's 180 out from compassion and kindness. Okay, things that he's done that ignored all science, whether it's the pandemic, you know, so living in denial instead of seeking wisdom. The tendency in the news media, and I think in a lot of our minds, was to demonize the individual, okay, instead of focusing on the specific behaviors. I mean, he behaved in the way that he did because of who he is, right? But if we, you know, whether or not, you know, the extent to which he may also be quite mentally ill is another matter. But I think to the extent that it's possible, just to focus on the behavior, you know, where we say that was a cruel act. That is the antithesis of compassion. That is the kind of behavior that, to the extent we're willing to see things in that way, the Buddha calls upon us to call out and to name for what it is.
Right.
That it is possible to say behaviors that are based upon ignorance, that are based upon greed, that are based upon hate and aversion, you know, are corrosive of our society, and they create tremendous social suffering. And so I do think that it's possible to bear witness to the Buddha's teaching in terms of policies without having to marry that with demonization. And I think it's difficult. You know, for the last 4 years, there have been many times that I've felt afraid, you know, that I've felt afraid, not personally, you know, I live a comfortable life. I have really felt tremendous fear for the future of our country, you know, and the future of our governmental institutions. I don't feel that kind of fear or dread or threat now. But I do not think the threat has passed. You know, there's still a third of the people out in the country right now who would live in an authoritarian regime if it meant rejecting their social status. They haven't gone away. And so I think the potential for policies that are cruel, that are based on the denial of what the science tells us about how to live a healthy life on Earth, the social forces to support those kinds of policies are going to still be there, and they still need to be called out. But in a way that is not accusatory of evil on the part of the other. That I think is where the work lies insofar as bringing the Buddha Dharma to bear. Is that responsive to your concern? Can't hear you.
Yes, okay. I muted again, and I shouldn't have.
That's okay.
It is, but it also carries over to, you know, why didn't our some senators say something about that? Why didn't my neighbor, who's a Trump supporter, say something about that? You know, and that's where you get. So it's not just Trump himself. It's
no.
They
tend to say those things when their constituents say you need to say those things. If that's the way it's supposed to work in our democracy. Carol, I saw your hand up too a little bit earlier.
Well, what I wanted to say was very much what Marilyn just said. Is what's the role of anger? I mean, I guess that's not very Buddhist, but. You know, I was thinking, what would we all be saying tonight if Trump had won? I think, I mean, we would be afraid. I would be afraid. And I would say, am I courageous enough to stand up to this threat to everything I think is important in this country? So, you know, I think it's a little easier to say now that we have a president that is decent and will uphold our institutions. But what would we have done if Trump had won? I don't know. I don't have an answer. I just kind of wonder about that and whether there's a legitimate role for anger at certain times.
Let me go to that question. I think that the answer is absolutely yes. You know, insofar as the need to recognize it for what it is. And again, anger, fear, flip side of the same energy field. Okay, in terms of neuroscience is coming out of the, you know, the limbic system, the one that perceives threat and what to do about it. So the anger, the fear, where does it come from? Fear for the loss of the way of life that we hold dear because of the political institutions that were designed to provide that way of life. Okay. So the people that voted for President Trump, a lot of them feel that those institutions of government are not working on their behalf. You know, that they've been taken over by elites, that they are suffering because the way these institutions have been functioning have been to their detriment. And that's why they would rather tear them down or not live under a democracy at all if it means them becoming even further disempowered. On the part of those of us, you know, and so the anger arises for everybody. What do we do with it? Are there ways that it can be transmuted or channeled into skillful action? That's the question. Okay. So, and that's what the challenge of living the Dharma is about, which is to say, how can we take the fear, the anger, the tension, and transmute it or convert it into some form of non-dual action that has a beneficial effect. When we act, we know from our own experience, our own practice, that when we act out of blind anger, it's usually an unfortunate result. You know, it can feel cathartic and empowering at the time that we do it, but it only is going to breed ultimately more discord, and you'll, in other words, breed more anger. Contrary to popular belief, it's the alternative is not being a doormat. You know, one of the things that brought at least the severity and the brutality and the cruelty of the Burmese military regime to an end was the monastics when they simply rose up en masse, you know, and they were horribly persecuted by the army. But they kept coming in such numbers, calling out the regime, that eventually some very substantial reforms, or at least things headed in the right direction, by virtue of the wisdom and the generosity and the kindness of their practice, overcoming that which they were facing. Unfortunately, it didn't go so far as preventing genocide, which is, of course, going on in their society now, but at least it, to some extent, democratized Burmese society. So I think, at least for me, and this is a total working edge for me as well, it's a matter of when you see the anger arise, if it's really powerful and you don't find yourself able to transmute it, you know, feel compassion for yourself for feeling the anger, and then find some way to convert that energy to beneficial use. Well, I can't do that. I just sit with it, watch it, you know. And I've done a lot of sitting with it and stewing about it and just being with it, marinating in it for a long time now. But I realized that it was, to some extent, a lack of courage on my part that kept me from being more forthright than I might have been insofar as publicly witnessing, you know, for the Buddhist teachings. I feel more encouraged now to do so. And I also find it really important to remember the courage, and the courage will be needed going forward. If we're going to more publicly witness the values that we care about, the courage is not the absence of fear. It's the arising of faith and equanimity in the presence of fear. Brian, one last one, and then we have to call it a night. Please speak.
Well, I went up and put on my purple shirt. I want to know what to do pretty soon. I understand the marinating part, but this is real hot for me. I mean, you all may have known, I don't know, you know, number of people on this Zoom. I was a homicide detective in Philadelphia. It was hot. I was on top of the things. I was a ghetto cop, basically.
Wow.
And I've been really trying to pull everything together now. And my daughter, my only daughter, is an ER doctor in San Francisco, working at three different ER facilities, and is stretching herself to the max, and was just called a racist. And that's exactly what she works on within her medical community. And she went home and fell apart and cried. So this is a tense time, and
yes.
I am just acknowledging the various pressures that come upon us all. And
yes.
I'm going to be a purple. I'm going to be a purple, and we'll see what happens. But gee whiz, it's tomorrow. It's the next day. It's the next day.
Yes.
I am so, my feet are so in the present.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think what I really appreciate you just having done is to remind us that we live in a field of raw, open wounds. You know, they're all about us. And they're, to some extent, within us as well. You know, it's like the Tibetan thing about all about us, the earth is covered with sharp stones. All about us, our very society, is covered in open wounds that need healing. And how to do that is the challenge before us. And like you just said, we need to be able to do so from a place of refuge. And the refuge is the present. It's just staying anchored in the honesty of the present moment, and then seeing what there might be within our hearts that will allow us to take skillful action. Thanks so much, man. Let's go ahead and take our sitting posture one last time and allow the eyes to gently close. When we let go of our battles and open our heart to things as they are, then we come to rest in the present moment. This is the beginning and the end of spiritual practice. Only in this moment can we discover that which is timeless. Only here can we find the love that we seek. Love in the past is simply memory, and love in the future is fantasy. Only in the reality of the present can we love. Can we awaken? Can we find peace and understanding and connection with ourselves and the world? May you live with ease, know ease and well-being. May you be safe from all inner and outer harm. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be free. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Have a good
week.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.